We're now on BBC Radio 4, What Makes a Musical Traitor? Stephen Johnson concludes his exploration of music during Paris's dark years of Nazi occupation with some of the war's most infamous tales of musical collaboration and heroic acts of resistance.
June 1941. A year since Adolf Hitler's triumphant stroll around a humbled Paris, and the city, as well as the war, remained in a cast-iron Nazi grip. France's military campaign was now a painful memory, but in the concert halls, theatres and recital rooms, a new front line had been established. France may not have been able to defeat Germany on the battlefield, but it could continue its struggle culturally. Two musical titans locked in a battle of artistic wills. These bruising skirmishes were to give birth to some of the occupation's most remarkable feats of resistance and infamous acts of collaboration. And nowhere was this battle more perfectly crystallized than in the art form equally venerated and dominated by both France and Germany, opera, as journalist Alan Riding explains.
Goebbels himself was very keen to impose German culture on France. Opera was immensely important to Germany, and it was a projection of German cultural power also. The French were already well trained in understanding and appreciating German music. And so it was really the best cultural visiting card that the Germans had.
I've come to the immense Palais de Chaillot on the left bank. A huge architectural semicircle with two sweeping wings split down the middle to frame Paris's most famous holiday snap, the Eiffel Tower. Over the 4 years of occupation, this former concert hall would become the nexus of the war's cultural battle, a place where French music lovers would flock to hear the finest musical talent Germany had to offer, the Berlin Philharmonic, the Staatskapelle, even the Army, Navy and Luftwaffe orchestras played here. Across Paris, the Nazis concocted an all-out musical charm offensive, a propaganda coup worthy of Goebbels's finest, using France's own love of high culture to subjugate it. In the midst of this struggle, the Germans claimed the scalps of two of France's most revered musicians. These are infamous tales of musical collaboration that cast a shadow over the nation's music even today.
She had sung during the 30s in front of Hitler, and he'd been very admiring of her voice and her performance and had sent flowers to her, and she'd been very excited by this. And she came to sing Isolde.
Germaine Lubin, the darling of French music, possessor of one of the purest and most beguiling female voices of the 20th century. With her statuesque figure and blonde hair, Lubin appeared the perfect Wagner soprano, despite the minor inconvenience of her nationality. Perhaps she just didn't realise how much war had changed everything, for when she stepped onto the stage of the Paris Opera in May 1941, clad as Wagner's Isolde, the ultimate German opera heroine, Germaine Lubin crossed a line. After all, Hitler's favourite soprano had already turned heads with her less than resistant attitude to the occupying soldiers.
She was rather prominent in the way that she associated herself with the Germans. Wagner's daughter-in-law, the dreadful Englishwoman Winifred, boasted that she'd arranged for Germaine's latest German lover. All of these things were quite messy. She had her moments of glory, but this came back to plague Germaine Lubin after the war.
France's greatest diva would later suffer for her musical treason, not to mention what was damningly called collaboration horizontale. And for the greatest French performer of his time, the temptation of playing the enemy's tune, not just musically, but politically, was to stain his reputation forever, as musicologist Myriam Chimène explains.
If we speak about this period, the first name you think about is Alfred Cortot. Alfred Cortot is a great pianist. He was an international star, conductor, a great teacher. And in 1939, when the war was declared, he decided to stop all his concerts. You can imagine, a star with the concerts everywhere in the world. And he went to work for Vichy. He continued to play in Germany. He also met some very important Nazis. And of course, he can't be ignorant of what happened to Jewish musicians. It's the only example of a musician involved in politics.
Strange enough, the work he did to professionalize French music was quite good, but at the same time, his association with the Germans resulted in punishment. But nonetheless, after a period of a few years in which he was ostracized, he rebuilt his career after the war.
I've come to the bustling northern suburb of Saint-Ouen. It's a Sunday afternoon and the district's famous flea market is in full swing. I'm not here, technically, to stock up on bargains, though it's very tempting. I've come to visit one of the most vibrant jazz bars in Paris, a shrine to one of wartime France's most brilliant and perhaps rather surprising musical icons.
It is really remarkable because he was vulnerable in so many other ways, and yet perhaps just his sheer talent meant that there were always someone somewhere who was willing to protect him.
Django Reinhardt was a Romany gypsy, a two-fingered jazz guitarist of genius, and one of Paris's most remarkable celebrities. Throughout the 4 years of occupation, French music lovers and Nazi officers alike crammed into venues across the city to catch his band, the Hot Club de France Quintet, performing their hit number Nuages, Clouds. Yet at the outbreak of war, Django had been touring in London. So why come back to a city where both his music and his gypsy blood might now be considered dangerously degenerate?
Although I think he probably had heard that gypsies weren't exactly popular in Germany, he went back and continued to perform. And the interesting thing is, quite a lot of Germans would go and listen to him, even though supposedly the Germans had decided that jazz was decadent and shouldn't be allowed.
Paris was the place where you can have fun, listen to forbidden music, to have sex. So jazz was one of these forbidden pleasures.
Earlier in the day, I'd met music expert Ludovic Tournez to explode some myths about jazz under the Nazis.
Of course, Hitler and many Nazis considered jazz as a degenerate music, but jazz was never forbidden during the occupation. What emerges from the success of jazz during this period is that jazz was the way for the French to appropriate the idea of liberty that they didn't have anymore.
Which is a fascinating parallel, isn't it? Because jazz comes from an oppressed people, the black Americans,
That's
who
true.
Had experienced slavery. Is oppression good for jazz, are we saying here?
Probably. That would be a very good subject.
Was it even a little bit of a liberation, maybe, for some of the Germans?
You have to consider the whole project of Hitler. Hitler wanted to transform France as a place of leisure for all his soldiers. The idea was France would be a very big seaside resort, you know, and especially Paris. So it was very important to keep the nightlife going on during all this period. So jazz was just one of these elements. And the other reason is that the more the French will degenerate by hearing jazz, the less they would think to the revenge. So it was a good deal.
You know? A way of disarming the resistance was to get them to listen to this degenerate music. Well, I wondered about trying to find my way to La Chope d'Épouse, but I needn't have worried. Just follow the sound of the guitars. Here they are, Espace Django Reinhardt. And this is the cafe itself. We better go in. I'm in the back room at La Chope d'Épouse, talking to Anne Legrand, a jazz expert who's very much up on this period in particular, and on Django Reinhardt. Now, maybe you could tell me, Anne, you'd have thought that someone like Django Reinhardt would have been out. Why do you think they not only tolerated him, but encouraged him?
They didn't want to arrest him. They want to hear him. At that time, he was famous, and he has some friend in the German army he knows before the war. And maybe some of them came to Paris to see Django Reinhardt.
Yes, it's funny, of course, there would be many, many more Germans who would want to hear this sort of thing than would want to hear Wagner, actually.
Yeah. The German army wanted to have the quintet of the Hot Club de France to go to Germany for a German tour. And he didn't compromise. I don't know. It's a mystery. The mystery of beautiful music.
The mystery of beautiful music. Now there's an enigma which seems to lie at the very heart of this story. After all, what other art form could have this kind of battle? It's almost impossible to read concrete meanings into music, yet it can carry messages and embody emotions like no other medium. It's that unique ambiguity that makes examining the story of music under the occupation, the tales of jazz-loving Nazis and French patriots flocking to see the Berlin Phil, so uniquely fascinating. Yet there was a group of people in Paris for whom music became an unmistakable symbol of defiance, a section of society in whose hands musical protest always seems to be being born, its youth.
La musique nègre et le jazz sont déjà de vieilles machines.
The Zazous were one of wartime Paris's most curious subcultures, a motley band of young music fans with big hair and big attitudes that took their name from a song by the French band leader Johnny Hess. In the narrow alleyways of the famous Latin Quarter, I met Ricky Stevenson, tour guide and expert in the African-American culture of Paris, to find out more.
Zazou referred to the hip cats, the African-American musicians who came to Paris following World War I. So in the 1920s, this was a place where they could record their music, where they could be respected for their music. And it was just mimicking that African-American culture that they loved.
And as you say, mimicking, because it certainly didn't just appeal to black people, did it? A tremendous following among young French people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because within a month after the Germans occupied Paris and the Vichy government came into existence, there were like 78 articles, newspaper articles, that appeared denouncing the Zazou, who wore their jackets long with the big shoulders and the girls with fluffed up hair and the guys with the fluffed up hair, who were really in love with what the Germans called, well, I won't say the word, but they called it the Jewish N-word music.
Yeah. Well, we're standing actually in an area that's pretty relevant to the Zazou culture. Perhaps you could set the scene for us, Nick.
Saint-Michel. It's where these young, hip cats could go down into these cabs. And that's where the music would take place, and kids would be swinging and dancing. And, you know, they're told, no, you can't dance, you can't do this. But they're wearing their clothes, and they could spot each other.
And yet, this is under an occupying power. This is really serious stuff.
And what was interesting was that when the Jews of Paris were forced to wear the big yellow star, the Zazous took that same big yellow star and would put on it jazz or Zazou. And in fact, by 1942, they were being dragged out from the nightclubs and beaten. So it's a chapter that's not always told.
But just as Paris's jazz-loving youth were rebelling, some of French classical music's greatest names were meeting in secret to found their own covert resistance group. Its last living member can still remember the number etched on his membership card.
Le Front National des Musiciens. Myself, I have my card number 11.
For me, 95-year-old Henri Dutilleux is France's greatest living composer, someone who actually lived through Paris's musical war. I couldn't come to Paris without meeting him. His English is faltering, and you'll hear him in translation as our conversation moves backwards and forwards between French and English, as at his studio on the Île Saint-Louis, he took me vividly back in time to those dark days, telling me how the music of the great Claude Debussy had inspired him and his colleagues to rise up against the occupier after France's devastating defeat had robbed him of his creative gifts.
I was in the army of the avion. I had the luck because, hélas, immediately the French army was battu. It was a disaster.
You managed to get musical work at this period, and I believe you conducted the chorus at the Opéra de Paris at this time.
Yes. Mm. It was not important.
It was not important?
No. It was a kind of a remplacement. You know, at this moment, each time I tried to write, I was without ideas.
You were without ideas?
Yes, c'était vraiment le grand désastre. Mm.
Can you remember how musical life in Paris changed when the Germans arrived?
Of course. D'abord, le résultat.
We all felt the effects of the Nazis' anti-Semitic laws. Jewish composers couldn't publish any pieces or play in any orchestras. They lost every single one of their rights.
It was impossible for them to live. And it was not a decision of the German. It was anticipé.
The Vichy government actually anticipated the Nazis' policies against the Jews. They couldn't even wait for the German laws to come into effect. And that's the really shameful thing.
C'est vraiment la honte.
What do you remember about the concert life during the occupation?
Comment vous dire?
How can I explain it to you? One thing I remember vividly, but with great sadness, was that in September 1940, there was a very important performance of Debussy's Pelléas and Mélisande at the Opéra Comique, with members of the French public mingling with German officers. I'm really not sure what they thought of it. But I was there. And it was extraordinary because we were able to say, yes, French culture is still alive through Debussy's music. And our enemy knew it too.
French music was being reborn, like the phoenix from the ashes, in front of Henri Dertilleux's eyes, in the historic performance you're listening to now. The opera and its composer were immensely symbolic. Pelléas and Mélisande are truly French heroes, the antithesis of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. The opera's composer, Claude Debussy, was a cultural icon, a man whose music had reacted against German influences, defied the deadening Teutonic hand of Wagner to create a new, uniquely French musical style. Amid the turmoil of the Great War, just months before his death, Debussy had galvanized French patriotic fervor by signing his manuscripts Claude de France. We began this program with the story of how Germany had tried to poison the wellspring of French culture, to use a nation's own love of music against it. But soon, the tables were turning. Backstage at the Opera House, where once an awestruck Hitler had toured the labyrinthine corridors and dressing rooms, I had an appointment with Aurélien Poidevin, resistance historian, to find out how France overthrew musical oppression and made the opera stage a white-hot crucible of resistance.
Je ne pourrais plus sortir de cette forêt.
Aurélien, you have a picture here, a wonderful picture, from the 28th of December 1940, so very soon after the occupation, which shows life at the opera apparently going on absolutely as normally here. Well-dressed people, this grand staircase. You wouldn't believe that an invasion had taken place.
Yes, I think opera is very important for the Germans, but the people are going to hear French music, and Germans have to pay.
So everybody had to pay, including Nazi high officials.
Yes.
One of the most important names of this time is the conductor Roger Desormières. Can you tell me a little bit about his role?
In 1941, Roger Desormières conducted a recording of Pelléas and Mélisande. It was very important because this is French music, Claude Debussy.
Is this important because Pelléas is very obviously in spirit not a German opera?
Everybody in Paris knows Claude Debussy is Claude de France. Mm. And at the first evening of Pelléas and Mélisande, when the curtain goes up, the singer Irène Joachim sees many German officials in the room. And she thinks the French have to prove that they are here in Paris.
You have here in your hands a statement by the Resistance. Nous refusons de trahir. We refuse to be traitors. What sort of things did the Front National do, Aurélien, to promote resistance?
The Front National de la Musique promoted the French music and the French musician. And the Nazis were only able to impose four new big German works during the whole war. There was a ballet of Werner Eck, a Nazi composer, in August 1942. At the first evening, the director decided to program a second ballet composed by a French musician, Francis Poulenc, who is a member of the Comité de Front National de la Musique. The title is Les Animaux Modèles.
Francis Poulenc was very sly at these small, almost imperceptible acts of resistance, and I think he's really unique in having done this during the war.
Musicologist Leslie Sprout.
I think one of the most famous is his ballet, Les Animaux Modèles, that was performed by the Paris Opera in 1942. Near the end of the ballet, in the orchestral score, he cites this 1871 protest song from the German annexation of Alsace and Lorraine. And it's a very quick little citation, but it was a very well-known song to the French. It's unlikely that any of the Germans would have recognized it.
You'll never have Alsace-Lorraine, taunts the song Poulenc so cheekily quoted. And before long, as musical and military resistance to the Nazis grew to a maelstrom, the French would have their beloved capital back.
Here is the news, read by Richard Wessel. Paris has been liberated.
It's been one of the most marvellous sights I've ever seen, coming down the boulevard into the heart of Paris. Everywhere we went, people came running out of their houses, out of the shops, shaking hands with us. Here they are, they're just mad with joy. Just listen to these crowds.
With the liberation came a great desire for revenge.
Journalist Alan Riding.
The question, of course, was what was collaboration? And that became the difficult thing. And in the world of music, it was really a bit blurred.
Despite the liberation, darkness wasn't banished yet, as the inquest into Paris's curious cultural renaissance began. Unlike writers, who would be condemned or reprieved by their words, musicians were left to rely on how their actions and decisions could be interpreted. These were hardly clear-cut, decisions that, as I've discovered throughout, were pulled in every direction by questions of ideology, continuity, and the sheer need to survive. Yet all these subtleties were lost in the immediate aftermath of finger-pointing and counter-accusations. And as the storm grew deafening, even France's most revered entertainer, Maurice Chevalier, found himself on the run from both the Nazis and the French resistance. Yet despite being arrested on charges of collaboration, France's favourite cheeky chappie counted on his enduring fame and on the short memories of his fellow countrymen to get him out of this sticky situation.
He was freed very quickly, and he managed somehow to apologise his way and explain that he was not a collaborator, and he was able to recover. And by the 50s, people had forgotten all about that.
Paris sera toujours Paris, la plus belle ville du monde.
In the end, France's post-war period of recriminations, the so-called épuration, was to be fierce, but mercifully short-lived. A young general called Charles de Gaulle had a country to rebuild. Ironically, just as the Nazis had used music to soothe and distract Paris's population, de Gaulle's new France also tapped into music's unique, powerful magic to help its nation forget. Within a few years, Maurice Chevalier, Alfred Cortot, Charles Trenet, and other alleged collaborators had all been welcomed back onto the stage with open arms. All except, that is, for a certain horizontal collaborator, Hitler's favourite soprano.
The process of purification was highly uneven, and Germaine Lubin, is kind of hard in her case to really pin down what exactly they objected to.
I think the fact that she was standing on stage with a German conductor and a German orchestra and was triumphing would probably have stirred the hearts of quite a lot of French people. Anyway, all of this came back to plague Germaine Lubin after the war, and she was really dragged through the mud. She was jailed and went through numerous trials, and the press just chopped her up, and her career really was totally destroyed.
It was time to move on, to forget those unimaginably complicated dark years. To do so, de Gaulle's new nation told itself a tale that the French had all stubbornly, silently refused to make music with their hated occupiers. It was a potent myth that was to colour French culture for more than half a century, as the young musicologist Leslie Sprout discovered.
For a long time, no one really spoke about any of these issues because they were so highly charged. I arrived in France in August 1994, so it was very auspicious since the whole city was celebrating the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Paris. I went to a reception that had two elderly ladies in particular who were very keen to talk to me about music. They asked me what I was working on, and when I told them, there was dead silence for a few minutes, and then one of them said, well, there was no French music during the war. The only music during the war was the German Luftwaffe military band in front of the opera, and everybody else was silent. And this was somewhat of an awkward moment.
Perhaps it's only now, with the suffering and shame of the occupation a lifetime ago, that this remarkable story of how some of France's greatest musical figures, from the gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt to the heroic teacher Claude Delvincourt, from the sly melodies of Francis Poulenc to the stirring voice of Edith Piaf, of how they all use their talent and their art to battle the Nazis on the stages of Paris, can be finally told in all its fascinating, colourful complexity.
Stephen Johnson, and Music in the Dark Years was produced in Cardiff by Stephen Rajam.